Harry Poe is our next speaker.
I was interested in the reaction of various groups and folks to the Y chromosome Adam and mitochondrial Eve studies some years ago. ASA had its most successful issue of perspectives when it focused on that particular issue. And we sold, we had to do another run. Is that right, Andy? Fabulously successful run, and congratulations to all those who participated in it. But I was fascinated by the reactions of different folks to the basic data. And that's what I'd like for us to think about a little bit, perhaps as a case study of how intuition works versus how tradition works in how we look at things. A little background. I am a Baptist, a traditional Baptist. Baptists believe in what's known as the age of accountability, which is to say we do not believe that humans inherit the punishment of sin, that we are held innocent by God until an indeterminate age. Paul said in Romans 7, verse 9, I once was alive apart from sin. But when the law came, sin sprang to life and I died. So that would be the scriptural understanding of the Baptist idea. So I reacted entirely differently to this information, this data, these studies, than my Calvinist friends, who would have an Augustinian understanding of the universality of sin. Baptists have a more Irenaean understanding of the universality of sin. So that's in the background. Now, when we think about tradition versus imagination, I do a lot of interdisciplinary work and a bit of work with my cousin Edgar. Edgar Allan Poe was very much concerned with how imagination works. And he differed from the Romantics, who sort of relegated it to fancy. And he said that every major scientific breakthrough that has ever occurred has been the result of imagination rather than calculation. Calculation uses the information we now have. It doesn't discover new information. Calculation explores what the imagination proposes, but calculation doesn't propose. And so C.S. Lewis joined him in that. So those are two areas that I've been fascinated by, just the whole idea of imagination and how it works. Cousin of mine was minding his own business, sitting on a park bench one day, when it occurred to him that light could be amplified by stimulations of emissions of radiation, and you'd be able to go through the checkout counter at the grocery store faster. Charlestown's and the laser. It was an experience of imagination. Now, he had to calculate. He had to experiment to work out exactly how that works. But the idea, the very idea of having an idea, is something remarkable that humans experience. And in the course of the day, all of you have been very imaginative. In the course of the lecture earlier today, most of us got up, left the room, went somewhere, took care of something, had a conversation with somebody, came back, started listening again, then went somewhere else and did something else, right? You had visions, you heard voices, but we don't talk about that sort of thing because we don't want people to think we're crazy. Because what we've tended to do is normalize the aberration. That is, when I was a prison chaplain, the man who was concerned about the aliens who had inserted this thing thing in his brain. And that's his imagination, but it's a broken imagination. All of us have imagination, though we tend, in a sense, we've been trained to ignore it in our culture. So, you can think of Edison, who saw an electric light. He saw that something could have electricity go through it, and he wouldn't have to have a candle anymore. But it took, 3,000 experiments before he found a carbonized cloth thread that actually did it. So there's a relationship between imagination and experimentation. So that's what I want us to think about for a moment with the most recent common ancestor. Now, in the Y chromosome study, the male study, the determination was that the most recent common ancestor lived 50,000 years ago, or 120,000 to 156,000 years ago, or 180 to 200,000 years ago. And this is Y chromosome Adam. With the most recent common female ancestor, the mitochondrial study demonstrated that she lived 170,000 years ago, or 99,000 to 148,000 years ago, or this is mitochondrial Eve. Now, I'm not making fun of these studies because the numbers are different. It took more studies to discover more things about what size sample you need, and you'll get different answers depending on how you conduct the study. When Jimmy Davis and I went to Bob Russell's seminar in Berkeley in 1998 or 99, I think it was, the universe was, 18 billion years old? When we wrote our first book together, the universe was 15 billion years old. When we wrote our third book together, the universe was 13.5 billion years old. And when we did our last book, the universe was 13.7 billion years old. That isn't to disparage the science. That is to notice that science is always getting a clearer picture of things as techniques develop, as advances come. But notice the age, the period difference when Y chromosome Adam lived, say with the first one 50,000 years ago, and mitochondrial Eve 170,000 years ago, and it goes to the popular press, and the names Adam and Eve, they're not in the studies. The studies aren't concerned with the Bible. It's looking at mutation rates in the male line and in the female line. But you imaginatively change the meaning of the data to people when you mix your metaphors. And so the conclusion was drawn, therefore, Adam and Eve were not real people. Then it becomes a theological issue based on a false application of the scientific data. And one of the things that comes through in these articles is a level of anger. And those of you who've read them know what I'm talking about. There's a level of anger. I remember my response when I first heard about the debate. My dean called me in. He knew I worked in science and religion. He wanted to know, what do you think about this? I laughed. I thought it was a joke. Now, my reaction was different based on my context, my own background. One of the things is that the most recent common ancestors by these two methods are not the most recent common ancestors. Y'all all know that, I'm assuming. So let's. My interest in this all began when, before Francis Collins and the human genome was was mapped out. It began with the discovery of the bones of the Romanovs. And remember, that was the first big, famous international DNA study that was a mitochondrial study of ancestry to determine that these were, in fact, the bones. Do y'all remember that? Yes, it was fabulous. And I wrote a novel based on it because I had an immediate imaginative grasp of something. One of the a major Russian scholar gave a lecture in Louisville about the discovery, and his conclusion was that it would have been impossible for anyone to have escaped the execution at Yekaterinburg. And in a moment, I had the entire plot of a novel because I didn't think it was true. I wrote it as a novel, not as a piece of nonfiction, of how they could have escaped 2 weeks prior. I won't go into all of that, but it's the sort of thing that some novelists have. They have, in a moment, the entire story. This is the case with J.K. Rowling and the 7 Harry Potter novels. She grasped the entire series in a flash. It's when you suddenly see what no one has seen before. You create a world. So I had this interest in that kind of a study, but my interest preceded that. I grew up in the South. Most Southerners are on very good terms with their dead relatives and don't speak to their living relatives. When my great aunt died, I got some of her things, and one was this book that was about the old families of Pendleton District, South Carolina. And what I want to point out is this little note my great-grandfather made in the margins. Many descendants of Nancy Tremere identified through the lineage a form of insanity. Examine the record for those marked T. T, 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 T. And you flip through the book as they intermarried with different families. And he had identified over about 5 generations how a certain trait had gone through families. What I want to suggest to you is the average person who knows anything about family understands that some things are passed on and that mutations occur. I am a mutant, like the X-Men. I have a knot right there. You see it? If the Lord doesn't come back 10,000 years from now, my descendants will have very prominent horns on their heads. My mother has this same knot. Okay. So most people have an intuitive grasp of the basic idea of heredity. How are we on time?
Okay. You're only 10 minutes into it.
Oh, good. Which brings us to a song from the 1940s, country music song. Some of y'all are old enough to know. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. And it's about a fellow whom there were all sorts of problematic intermarriages and that. So he wound up marrying his grandmother, but it was funny. But that's my situation, almost, not quite. This is General John Bayliss Earle. And when I was dating Marianne Whitten from Memphis, visited her home, pulled a book down off the shelf that her uncle had written his family history, and lo and behold, she's my cousin, which explains why our daughters are striped and polka-dotted. But it's a long, convoluted story, but this is why I laughed at the conclusions that were being drawn about an attempt to correlate a Y chromosome study with a mitochondrial study by generations and assigning a time to the generations. Marianne and I have... Oh, there's a light, isn't there? Up there? Yes. So, here's General John Bayless Earle. He has a father, Colonel John Earle. Mary Ann is descended from his second wife. I'm descended from his first wife. And you go down first to this generation. Mary Ann, I've misspelled her name. Oops. Is my grandfather's generation. You see the problem? And my two daughters are my father's cousins in that generation. So you see what's going on there. So this is intuitively what I was laughing about. It's not science. It's something else. Now, you can do generations. You can average generations if you've got the starting point and you know how many generations have taken place and the ending point. See, pretty easy math to do. You do it with fruit flies. People are a little trickier. And so what I was laughing at was the problem of developing an average length of time for a generation, because a generation is not a standard unit of measure. It's sometimes thought that way, but it's not. It's an X. It's a variable. And you have to assign a value to it. A generation works like a bunch, gobs, a myriad, a country mile, a herd, a flock, a school, a gaggle, a pinch, a dash, a smidgen. Now, you can assign a value to it. It's a tricky thing. So I think this can be done. Bob was talking about a proposal for research on Friday. I would like to see a study done that used DNA from mummies. And, can the DNA be extracted from mummies? There are a lot of things that you couldn't do that now you can do. I mean, now we can get gushy parts out of dinosaur relics. We've seen that here at... that presentation was done several years ago in plenary here at ASI. Might not be able to do it now. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility to do it, but then you would get some markers farther back that would at least move you toward that business of refining and refining and refining. One of the problems is that males and female generations may differ by as much as 40%. I was Strom Thurmond's page when I was 16 years old, United States Senate page. When I was 16, he qualified for Social Security. And Strom Thurmond had two wives. The first wife did not bear children, but he had many mates. His second wife did bear children. We continue to live in a polygamous society where the females produce generations at one rate, but where the males produce generations at another rate. So you can develop a logarithm for figuring out all of that. But it's, I think that's a tricky thing and one of those research problems. What was funniest to me, and as I was reading the blogs, people driven by different issues. So you've got Eve living 170,000 years ago, Adam living 50,000 years ago, and the arguments were going everywhere. But Y chromosome Adam had a mama and a daddy. So, I mean, if you're going to misuse scripture and assign names randomly to studies that aren't about Adam and Eve, it would be more appropriate to say that the Y chromosome study had discovered Y chromosome Seth rather than Y chromosome Adam. To me, that was funny. And so that was the reaction. But notice the response, traditional ways of thinking about things were having to a particular study that wasn't studying the Bible. Y chromosome Adam and mitochondria Eve are not Adam and Eve. They weren't intended to be. So that's an intuitive observation. Here's another one on the other side. Adam and Eve and their friends. So what the studies were saying was that the first humans probably arose in a population group of a few thousand people. Okay, now, does the Bible allow that? Well, oddly enough, I think it does. Let us fashion humans in our... oops, that's image. Take out that S. Let us fashion humans. It's a collective. It's a collective. The fashioning was of humans. So that doesn't say the Bible teaches that. I don't think the Bible teaches any particular science. I think it allows a range of sciences. One of the remarkable things to me about the Bible is that it has allowed a variety of sciences over a long period of time. So, it allows that. Whoever finds me will kill me. There's Cain. Well, now, who's the whoever? Now, there's not a man in this room who at some time hasn't thought, Daddy's going to kill me. Or, Mama's going to kill me. He's not concerned about Mom and Daddy at this point. He's concerned about the whoever as he roams around the world. So who? It's like that, there was a movie made back in the 50s with Vincent Price, The Last Man in the World, and he's not alone. And it was remade in the 70s with Charlton Heston, the Omega Man.
He's the last man in the world, but he's not alone.
And then it was remade, a year or two ago with Will Smith. Same idea, last one. Well, you know, here we have Cain. He's not alone. What's that about?
20-minute mark.
Okay, good. We're gonna finish this. So the Bible doesn't teach this kind of evolutionary biology, but it allows it. So I think, again, that's an intuitive observation. Now, this is a research proposal that comes out of this, because this is my real concern in all of this. What does it mean to be human? Because we don't really have a commonly accepted definition in theology, science, or philosophy. So what it means to be human. We've just always sort of known. I know it when I see it. Well, now we're getting into areas where that's not quite good enough. Now, Darwin didn't really allow for species. That was the point. Everything is a moving target. But we're concerned theologically and biblically for the image of God. And what does that mean? So I think... this is an area that has been neglected for a long time, and I think it's very important in sorting out the confusion. I think it relates to the new creation. I think the creation relates to the new creation. In many ways, if this model is correct, that Adam and Eve arose in a population group. That is to say, if the first humans were in a population group, they function like Sarah and Abraham, who were in a population group and yet were selected. But it also corresponds to the new creation, or the new creation corresponds to the original creation, that we were one thing, a child of the dust, and then we became a child of God. So maybe something like that is going on, but I think this is an area of study, research, that needs to be undertaken and grappled with. My conclusion in all this is not very profound, not so huge. But it is the idea that the Creator has not retired. I was talking with a group a few weeks ago and talking about God's activity in the world today. God is active in the world. And a very conservative, orthodox Calvinist said, "No, that's an unacceptable view." And I said, "Why is that an unacceptable view?" "Because that would undermine his eternal decrees." And I thought, oh my goodness, your orthodoxy is leading you into heresy. That you've just lopped off omnipresent. You've just done away with the Holy Spirit. And this is, I think, is one of the dangers in a highly polarized and highly charged period of emotion within the church of thinking about these matters. So I'll leave it there and let y'all fight for a while. You got any time left?
Yeah, we got about 5 minutes.
About 5 minutes.
The Smithsonian would define a human as being a bipedal mammal, which would put humans around 6 million years ago. Paleoanthropologists normally define human as use of stone tools, which would be about 2.5 million years ago. So there is commonly accepted definitions of human.
Well, what I want to suggest is you've just proven that it's not commonly accepted because you've got two different definitions with two different periods of time. Different disciplines define humanity in different ways. Almost every discipline has a stake in what it means to be human. And we tend to be reductive in our definition. So one is going to be morphological, and that's how you define humanity. One will have to do with manufacturing, what tools, whatever they've done. And you can go around different disciplines. One will stress language, and thus we don't have a commonly agreed upon definition.
Never will.
Ah, despair. Yes.
Random's the same way. I mean, there's not a simple definition of
random. What if we were to say that we have not yet seen what it is to be fully human, but yet we have, because we've seen the incarnation of Jesus Christ?
Well, but we did have something before Jesus,
right.
And so it's the image of God from a theological, biblical perspective. Yeah. It's what makes us different from the other animals is the image of God. Mm-hmm. And but the paleontologists wouldn't accept that.
Right. Theologically speaking, we'll be fully human when we're drawn up within communion within the Trinity in Christ. So.
But that's eschatological. That's what Bob is interested in.
Yeah.
But in terms of the past, when are you sort of born again? Can you say there was a time when something was hominid but not human, and then human? And I would think that from a secular evolutionary perspective, that would be the case. Just a gradual change. It's sort of human. Yes.
From a biblical perspective, there you tread on what is the image of God that determines humanity?
I think we, by its very presence in the scriptures, we're encouraged to ask the question, to explore it. Yeah, I think that's what we're to meditate on and ponder. Difficulty in answering the question. Yeah, we haven't answered the question since we've had the scriptures. Yeah. Thank you.